There are only a few public figures in this country who are instantly identifiable by a single name, and one of them is Tommy. Tommy Douglas. He has been Tommy for 40 years. As a prairie preacher, as a member of parliament, as premier of Saskatchewan, as a member of parliament again, and now as he retires from the leadership of the New Democratic Party as a Canadian institution. Few Canadians have been introduced more often at public meetings and conferences and banquets and thousands of other gatherings. And when he's introduced by the chairman, they usually give some biographical details about him, and there's quite a lot to say about Tommy Douglas. He was born in Scotland, the son of an iron molder, came to Canada at the age of 14, lived in Winnipeg at the time of the general strike, which certainly had an effect on his social outlook. At university, Brandon College, McMaster, University of Chicago, he was a brilliant debater, a gold medalist. I'm certain his sermons were a delight. He was ordained in the Baptist Church. His first call was to Weyburn, Saskatchewan. But he's been a politician for 36 years. He was first elected to the House of Commons in 1935, re-elected in 1939, and after he resigned to accept the leadership of the Saskatchewan CCF, he won in 1944, as almost everybody knows, a smashing victory. He was premier for 16 years until he accepted the leadership of the New Democratic Party in 1961 and re-entered the House of Commons. Quite a career. Chairmen love to dwell on it when introducing him, and they usually sprinkle their introductions with laudatory remarks. Tommy reacts to such introductions with modesty, persistently wondering with some humor what the fuss is all about. Here he is at the beginning of an important address to delegates to a meeting of the Cooperative League of the United States.
May I thank you for your very fine demonstration of welcome. May I thank you, sir, for your very kind words of introduction. Being a politician, I don't always get such laudatory introductions. I get introductions of all sorts and descriptions. I think my strangest introduction, however, was once going to a theological college where I was to be the guest speaker at the graduation dinner of these young clergymen. And I was introduced by one of the young theologues. And he got up and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "it is my privilege this evening to introduce the premier of the province." He said, "This would make some people nervous, but it doesn't bother me at all." He said, "For several years now, I've been helping to run a church camp for boys and girls. One summer, we had a little boy come to camp whose name was Peter. Peter got along fine at the camp until one night for supper, they had prunes. Peter didn't like prunes, so he wouldn't eat them. Lady in charge came around and said, 'Peter, eat those prunes.' 'No, don't like them.' 'Peter,' she said, 'eat those prunes or God is going to punish you.' Well, that was different. Peter started to eat the prunes. And he ate the prunes until he got down to the last one. He just couldn't take any more. Punishment or no punishment, he'd had it, so he quit. Lady came back, she said, 'Peter, eat that prune.' 'No.' Well, she said, 'Peter, we're going to leave that saucer there, and you'll be glad to eat it.' After supper, the children played ball. Later on, they went off to bed. During the night, one of those storms that we get on the prairies came up. Thunder rumbled, the lightning flashed, the wind shook the old building, the rain came down in torrents. Children were terrified. They huddled together in the center of the dormitory floor. Those in charge came in, quietened them down, got everybody back in bed. Everybody tucked in, except one. Peter's bed was empty. Lady in charge said, 'I think I know where he is.' Down to the dining room she went, turned on the light. Here was Peter sitting up at the table eating this prune. He looked up at her with these big blue innocent eyes and he said, 'Say, that was a hell of a fuss about one little prune, wasn't it?'"
Tommy Douglas is an orator in the old-fashioned tradition. He believes that speech is the most important instrument any politician has to communicate, to educate, and to convince. A typical Douglas speech lasts about an hour, and it's followed by a question-and-answer period. It always begins with a smattering of funny stories to put the audience at ease and make them receptive. And then Tommy moves directly into one or more of the major issues of the day. The state of the economy, inflation, unemployment, Medicare, social planning, foreign ownership, youth, technology, change. He'll choose one or two or three of those topics depending on who the audience is and where he's speaking and what the front pages say that day. And you'll notice that he never misses an opportunity to speak about the future. of a better day and a better world, and that he always challenges people to act, to decide what they want, and to select the men and the parties who don't manipulate people but who serve them. Policies with him are always secondary to people and their needs. In 1945, a year after taking office, Tommy Douglas broadcast an important speech in opposition to an application by vested interests to disallow some of his government's legislation in Saskatchewan. The CPR, the insurance companies, the mortgage companies wanted Ottawa to veto three new laws which proposed to tax mineral rights when they were held for speculation, which protected farmers being crushed by heavy mortgage debts, and which gave further protection to municipalities still struggling under the burden of Depression year debt. In this speech, Tommy Douglas fights for the principle that the people are free to determine policies which deal with their problems. And under the kind of attack that you're about to hear, the federal government refused to entertain the petition by the vested interests to veto the provincial legislation. Tommy concluded his broadcast in this way.
Let me here issue a word of warning to those who are moving heaven and earth to have this legislation disallowed. I want to tell them that they're not dealing in this case with a government of tired old men who are merely holding on to power for the spoils of office or with the hope of finding a final resting place in the Senate. They're dealing with a government fresh from the people, with a mandate to carry out the people's wishes. Those wishes will be carried out. If these vested interests succeed in persuading the federal government to disallow this legislation, we still have other resources at our disposal, and we will not hesitate to use them. We were elected to protect the homes and the security of our people, and we will use every legitimate method which we possess to attain that end. These governments who want the present legislation destroyed may well find that what will take its place will be even less palatable than that to which they now object. If they insist on this arbitrary and high-handed method, they may find that what they get will be even worse than what they have now. My object in speaking to you tonight is to let you know that the government is not prepared to retreat one single inch. The one thing we must know, however, is that the people of this province are behind us in our determination to fight this invasion of our democratic rights by the financial baron. The legislation in question has not yet been disallowed. We still have 3 weeks. 3 weeks in which to write your members of parliament. 3 weeks in which to send resolutions from municipal councils, city councils, and various farmers, labor, and businessmen's organizations. We have 3 weeks in which to let the federal government know that the people of Saskatchewan will not take lying down this despotic interference with democratic government. This is no time for fair-weather friends and sunshine soldiers. This is a time for men and women of all political parties, races, and creeds to stand shoulder to shoulder in defense of their democratic right to elect governments to do their will without interference from any corporation, no matter how large or how powerful. In the past few years, a conviction has been growing that governments are always on the side of concentrated wealth and against the common man. This belief has not been without some foundation. The time has come for Saskatchewan to express itself vigorously and vehemently against such a negation of democracy. We are prepared to lead that fight if you are prepared to follow us into battle. The Saskatchewan government was elected by the people of this province. We were not elected to protect the interests of special privilege. We were not elected to become puppets of those who sit in high places and pull the strings. We were elected to give our people security in their homes, to give them reliable protection in their dealings with powerful corporations. And we were elected to see to it that those same corporations should make some financial contribution to a higher standard of social services. Our objectives have not changed. We are still determined to do the things we were elected to do. We are neither surprised nor dismayed by the attempts of these powerful interests to resist progressive change. The fight to preserve democracy across the sea has just finished. The fight to make democracy a reality at home is just beginning.
That was a speech dealing with a local issue, but now we are going to hear Tommy Douglas leave this narrow base and move on to a broader one, speaking here not just as a citizen of Saskatchewan or even of Canada, but as a citizen of the world. During his years as premier, he made countless speeches to teachers, and this is a pretty typical excerpt from one of them.
I think that in our democracy, education must be concerned with the formation of character. Because in the final analysis, democracy depends on human character. You cannot have a democracy that functions if the great mass of the people don't believe in honest and efficient government. If they don't believe that the welfare of the community ought to take precedence over the welfare of any individual or any special group of individuals. And that will only come about when you have men and women who have a sense of value, who believe in honesty and truth and loyalty, who have an appreciation of beauty, and who have a fundamental belief in the spiritual nature of the universe in which we live. Now, primarily, of course, that's the function of the church. It's certainly also the function of the home. But it cannot be lost sight of in the school. There is very little use of the church teaching the child that he is a spiritual being, and of the parents teaching the child that he has a certain moral responsibility, if those who are imparting knowledge to the child leave him the idea that moral and spiritual values are unimportant. If democracy is to survive and to succeed, we have to produce boys and girls who think in terms of this great world picture, who are concerned about the welfare of people the wide world over, whose minds are not limited to their own community or just to people with the same colors of skin and who speak the same language as they do. Because the next generation will have to think in global terms. We'll have to think in terms of sharing the abundance we have with those who have not, if the world is to be saved from the horror of an atomic war in this or in coming generations. That's the task we have, those of us who are shaping the lives of the citizens of tomorrow. That in the final analysis, while we do like to have monetary returns and while we like to have the comforts and amenities of life, the happiest people I have ever known are the people who took their satisfaction in intangible things, in the knowledge of the work they have done, in the consciousness of the contribution they have made to their day and generation, and the firm faith that they have left behind them something better because they've been there. Yours is a great profession. It brings great returns in terms of satisfaction. The poet may work with his imperishable lines, the artist with his paint and canvas, the sculptor with his marble. But all of these will eventually vanish away. But to you has been given the shaping of the world of tomorrow, the molding of the lives and personalities and the characters of the men and the women
who will guide the destiny of this nation and of the world in the years that lie ahead. It's a great responsibility. It's a great challenge. But I'm sure it's also a great source of satisfaction. I took a piece of plastic clay and idly fashioned it one day. And as my fingers pressed it still, it moved and yielded to my will. I came again when days were past, and that bit of clay was hard at last. It's still that early imprint bore. I could change its form no more. I took a piece of living clay and gently shaped it day by day. I molded it with power and art, a young child's soft and yielding heart. I came again when years were gone. He was a man I looked upon. He's still that early impress boy, and I could change him nevermore.
Now we're going to hear some Douglas jokes. You know, he constantly sprinkles his speeches with anecdotes of all kinds. These are generally drawn from the folklore and immediate experience of his audience, and he uses them in two ways. First, simply to entertain, as the next band suggests. And secondly, to make a point, as you will hear a little later on this record.
And I'm something like the old farmer and his wife who had a daughter who went off to the city, and she got herself a job and did very well and fell in love with a nice young boy, and she was thinking of getting married, and she wrote home and said to Mother and Dad, "Now, Mother and Dad," she said, I'm going to bring George home so you can meet him, and I hope you like him because I want to marry him." And she brought him home, and of course she told Father and Mother to be on the best behavior, and they were doing so. They had coffee in the living room, and then Mother said, "Now, Father," she said, "you take George and Mary and show them over the farm while I get dinner ready." So away Father went, and he was showing them over the place. And George, of course, was trying to make a good impression, too. He was praising everything he saw, what lovely stock, what fine buildings, what magnificent machinery. And when he got down to the garden, he said, "Why," he said, "Mr. Brown, I've never seen such big strawberries." Oh, the farmer was very modest and said, "Nothing to that. Anybody can grow strawberries. Lots of manure, put the manure on them." And he said, "Why, what a wonderful hedge you got." "Oh," he said, "lots of manure." "What big vegetable garden?" "No," he said, "lots of manure." That's the answer. The girl was getting more and more embarrassed, and presently she left the father and the boyfriend, and up to the house she came, and she said, "Mother," said, "you've got to do something with Father." Mother said, "What's wrong now, Mary?" "Well," she said, "he's down there with George in the garden talking about manure, manure." Said, "Mother, can't you teach him to say fertilizer?" Mother said, "Mary, it's taken me 25 years to get him to say manure." We're sorry that we've given you so much hot weather. This you can expect here. This is the country of drought and heat. They tell, you know, of the politician, one of those kind of politicians who'd rather be wrong than be quiet, who was making a speech in which he said, "Why, this is a fine province. There's nothing wrong with this province. All this province needs is lots of water and lots of good people." Some fellow at the back said, "That's all hell needs." The farmer who's hauling water in one of these to feed his stock, and one of these tourists going through said, "What are you hauling water for?" He said, "I'm hauling it to my stock." He said, "How far do you haul it?" He said, 2 miles. He said, "Why don't you put down a well?" "Well," he said, "about the same distance."
Tommy Douglas is a Burns enthusiast. In fact, he's more than that. He's a scholar of Robert Burns' work. He's committed great chunks of Burns' poetry to memory, and he's read just about everything there is to read about the poet. Why Robbie Burns? Well, after all, Tommy Douglas is a Scot, and Burns wrote about the ordinary people. Like Douglas, Burns takes his illustrations and subjects from everyday activity. He's a champion of the rights of the common man. He sings of freedom. He lived in a great period of social revolution, and he wrote about it. As Tommy himself has said, if today we have a better understanding of the dignity of man, if we believe in the worth of the common man, we owe much to the inspiration of Burns. But what appeals to him as well is Burns' humanity, his sensitivity, his great capacity for affection. The excerpts which you're going to hear, read by Tommy Douglas, deal with love and affection, as in the poems called Of All the Arts the Wind Can Blaw, and social and political justice, as in Man Was Made to Mourn.
One of the songs he wrote, which isn't so well known, is a song he wrote for his wife, Jean Armour. After Jean and he were married at Mauchline, he went to Ellisland, start a new life on a new farm. He had to build a home for her. So he was separated from his wife for many months, and he was very lonely. And he wrote a little song for her. As you know, Burns was not an easy man to live with. Jean Armour had many heartaches. Yet, when one recalls that she survived him by some 50 years, I often think that as she sat by the fireside at night and sang some of his songs, which were written for her, she must have felt that all her heartaches were worthwhile to have had such beautiful songs dedicated to the woman he loved. And there in Ellisland, he wrote what I think is his loveliest song. Of all the arts the winds can blow, I dearly love the west. For there the bonny lassie lives, the lassie I love best. There wild woods grow and rivers flow, and many a hill between. But day and night, my fancy's flight is ever with my Jean. I see her in the dewy flowers. I see her fresh and fair. I hear her in the tuneful birds. I hear her charm the air. There's not a bonny flower that springs by fountain, shaw, or green. There's not a bonny bird that sings but minds me of my Jean. He challenged the whole class structure of his day in what I think is one of his greatest poems, Man Was Made to Mourn. He said, see yonder poor o'er-labored wight, so abject, mean, and vile, who begs his brother of the earth to give him leave to toil. And see his lordly fellow worm, his poor petition spurn, unmindful that a weeping wife and helpless offspring mourn. If I'm designed yon lordling slave, by nature's law designed, why was an independent wish e'er planted in my mind? If not, why am I subject to his cruelty and scorn? And why has any man the right to make his fellows mourn?